Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello and welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem, and I always appreciate the opportunity to get together with you. And we've got a great hour ahead as we enjoy some conversation about some really fundamental aspects of our walk of faith, because it is a journey that we don't want to take on our own. And we want to learn today about the Great Commission. We think we know about the Great Commission, but there's a second part, the Great Compassion. In fact, that's the title of a new book from Paul Borthwick, Great Commission, Great Compassion. And let me introduce Paul, and then we'll get to our conversation. Paul serves as a senior consultant for Development Associates International. And in that the role, he teaches globally. I mean, he's taught in places around Africa and Sri Lanka and in Manila. And he also teaches regularly global Christianity at Gordon College in Massachusetts. He's written a number of books. This is his latest, just out from InterVarsity. And it is an opportunity for us to understand what it means to go and do. Paul, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be back with you.
So we think, you know, we know what the Great Commission says, but maybe we can just start with your suggestion that there are five Great Commissions.
Yeah, one of the things people forget, even though our Bible has Matthew 28, 18 to 20, the little heading says the Great Commission. That's the, you know, go and make disciples of all the nations and teaching them to obey everything. That's the one that most of us associate, but at the end of each of the Gospels and at the beginning of the book of Acts, which is Luke volume 2, Jesus gives final statements. These are all after he's risen up from the dead, before he ascends into heaven. It's as short as the John's Gospel where he says, as the Father has sent me, now I'm sending you. It's as long as the Matthew Gospel. It's go to preach all the world or all creation in Mark, beginning in Jerusalem after you receive power in Luke and in Acts, and then Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth, also Acts 1, verse 8. Basically, I underscore this in the book, that Jesus is saying these things recorded at different times in different places, but the gospel writers include them in their different forms because it's a reminder that Jesus kept reminding his disciples, you know, after I leave, after you receive the Holy Spirit, if you don't remember anything else, remember this. Live a sent life, go across cultures, and remember I'm going to be with you always.
Maybe we need to define what it means to go, because it seems, you know, over the course of the Christian history, we not many of us have gone.
Well, that's true, and I think you even see it in the book of Acts. Jesus, you know, commanded them. He says, you're going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. And yet they didn't leave Jerusalem until a persecution came. In Acts chapter 8, verse 1, it says the church was dispersed because of persecution to Judea and Samaria. And in Acts chapter 10, Peter very reluctantly crosses over into the culture of the Gentiles, which would be the beginning of the ends of the earth. So even if we are hesitant to go across cultures, at least we're in good company. You know, the church has always struggled with this. But the idea behind the Great Commission statements is we're going into the world, where we're going out and crossing cultures and looking for opportunities, starting in our own home area, which I would call Jerusalem. So that might be, you know, Minneapolis, or it might be Boston, or it might be wherever you find yourself, but then into your greater region, and then into across cultures locally. So Samaria could be anything from immigrants in our area to people living in institutional homes, you know, people who are geographically close but culturally distant. And then the ends of the earth would be literally the ends of the earth. And I think all of that's to say, we need to remind ourselves, which is the book is about, that the Christian life is about not just receiving, but actually from the receipt of God's Spirit in us, we go into the world as witnesses.
You know, we understand the idea of going as witnesses, and I guess we always think of probably a proclamation, but as the book suggests, there is also a demonstration. So say more about the Great Commission.
Well, this the phrase Great Commission, Great Compassion actually is, I owe it to Dr. Peter Kuzmich of Gordon-Conwell Seminary. He was referring to it in a class that he says, before the Great Commission of Matthew 28, you have the Great Compassion of Matthew 25. And Matthew 25 is that that difficult passage where the judgment of the nations is based on how they treated the poor, how they treated the hungry, the thirsty, I was a stranger and you welcomed me in, all those things. And as you did it to the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me, Jesus says. And Peter Kuzmich basically said the life of compassion is part of the Great Commission. So when Jesus says in Matthew 28, teaching them to observe everything or obey everything I've commanded you, that includes the way we treat the poor, the way we treat the homeless, the way we treat the immigrant or the refugee, all has to do with how we treat Jesus. Or to put it in simpler terms, the gospel is about proclamation and demonstration.
You reference a familiar verse to us. Well, I guess we know John 3:16-17, but few of us know 1 John 3:16-17. But those words are equally important too, aren't they? So maybe just review that lesser known 1 John 3:16-17.
Well, in a short summary, it's basically saying that if we have the world's goods, or we have something that people need, and we close our heart to the people around us, how does God's love live in us? In other words, so we are, in a sense, living out the gospel by the way we treat those right around us. So that's why, sometimes missions gets relegated to the over there. I've been in churches where they will talk about sending missionaries to North Africa, but they won't even reach out to the Muslim in their own community. And it's not about crossing a body of salt water. It's about living on witness, demonstrating God's love to the people right around us, as well as to the ends of the earth.
How does it has it developed in your life? Understanding that there's a proclamation and demonstration. I mean, you were in a pastoral staff here at Grace Chapel for some 20 years or so, and youth pastor, then minister, and so. I mean, this has been a passion for you for a long time, but just how has it grown and birthed in your own life?
Well, that's a great question that I think if I was going to trace it, I think it's working across cultures has really given me more of a realization that you can't just preach the gospel, you've got to demonstrate it. And here's what I mean. I live in upper middle class suburbia, outside of the Boston area. And in one sense, we live in a world where physical or human need, at least apparently, is taken care of. Whereas when I go to other parts of the world, they can't just preach to people. They also need to demonstrate God's love. In other words, if you're not caring for someone's hunger, you can't speak to their spiritual hunger. Or to use a phrase I think I heard from World Vision, empty bellies have no ears. And so it's been a lesson along the way. Now, coming back to the world of suburbia where I live, I also realize that there are many, many needs in the households represented in a nice, neat, and tidy suburb that need some sort of demonstrated love even before they hear the gospel as well. But I think it's working with people, if I could say it this way, who don't have the luxury of just preaching. That's taught me that it's both and. It's the gospel in word and the gospel in deed. It's, the preached word of Christ, and it's the touch of Christ. I mean, these things just balancing out. And it's been a long lesson learned as I've been more involved in situations where you see human need in such a great way that you realize you've got to respond to that. as or even before you give the priest word.
Talking today with Paul Borthwick. Paul's a senior consultant for Development Associates International. He teaches global Christianity at Gordon College in Massachusetts. He travels the globe as well, teaching in the seminaries in Manila or Sri Lanka or Nairobi, and has opportunity to work with the men and women that are seeking to expand their worldview and their understanding, and has written a wonderful new book. His latest is called Great Commission, Great Compassion, Following Jesus and Loving the World. And we're going to find out more about it in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Paul Borthwick is my guest today. This is Connecting Faith, and as we enter into this new year, we want to have a greater sense of God's calling and His commissioning to us. And so this book would be a must-reading for you as we talk Great Commission, Great Compassion, Following Jesus and Loving the World, written by Paul Borthwick, who is encouraging us to mobilize, that to go and do, go together. Paul, you talk about right at the outset of the book defining affluence, and just say a word about what that, how you define affluence, and then the implications of what that affluence should mean to us.
Yeah, I teach a class, as you mentioned, at Gordon College, and it's on global need. And I ask the question to my students: what's the greatest expression of our richness, our affluence in North America? And, of course, they'll say anything from the size of our highways to the size of our houses to our cars to our vacations, you know, all different expressions. And I'll say, no, 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 no. And then my answer is, I say, our greatest affluence is our affluence of choice. Years ago, Alvin Toffler in the book Future Shock talked about the day coming when we will suffer from overchoice. Well, that day is here. You know, you walk into a coffee shop and you have 24,000 ways your coffee could be prepared for you, you know, or you get a new cable TV subscription and you now have 400 channels to choose from. We have so many choices. And the reason that's significant is because, on the other hand, the essence of poverty is having no choices. You know, if I leave my nice, comfortable house in the suburbs, move to Calcutta, live with the homeless people there and die in the gutter of hepatitis, I'm still never going to be as poor as those people in the gutter, because I had the choice and they didn't. And so what I talk about is actually confronting us from the very beginning of the book on through it, is what are the choices I'm going to make? Because I would argue, even as followers of Christ, there's a lot of distractions in our culture, and we can choose to disregard the Great Commission of Jesus to make disciples of all nations. We can choose to live a happy, happy Christian life and sing in the choir and be a member of a church without really caring for the poor. We can choose those things, but I'm arguing in the book, if we say we've chosen to follow Jesus, those things, choosing to be involved with caring for a human need, choosing to be involved in the proclamation of the gospel, is all part of that one first choice to follow Jesus.
And I guess it's probably easy to say, well, what can one person do? I really can't make a difference. These are, you know, global poverty is a global issue, or, you know, whether it's, you know, trafficking or, you know, any, you know, the lack of, you know, clean water. Those, so it's easy to maybe just get despair because, you know, the world is broken. So what do we let that become a barrier to us?
Well, it's certainly overwhelming. And I can testify that, you know, I get overwhelmed by the needs that I see. Just the other day, I got an email from a couple that we met in Bangladesh. We met them in Nepal at a conference, but they're living in Dhaka, Bangladesh. And they told the story of finding a baby that had been discarded in a dumpster and was just being allowed to die in that dumpster. You know, and even that is just, it's so overwhelming. What can I possibly do about that? But, you know, we basically emailed and said, you know, because in many countries, you don't use insurance. You have to pay right up front for any health care. And they had taken the child to the hospital, and the child has subsequently passed away. But it sort of reminded me of just how overwhelming this all can seem. whether it's refugee crises or situations with genocide in some country here or war victims in some country there or, you know, floods in Mumbai, India. It's simply overwhelming. And what I try to encourage people is to say, don't try to meet the needs of the whole world, but try to be involved somewhere. Choose a location, you know, dive in to something and don't get so overwhelmed you don't do anything. And, you know, even let me give you an example. I was at a church in another part of the country, and this church was very concerned and dedicated to sending missionaries to the Muslim world. Now, as we all know, the Muslim world can be somewhat overwhelming, not just because of the sheer volume of it, but the images we get of the radicalness of things. Well, they were wanting to send missionaries to the Muslim world, which itself, like I said, can be an overwhelming proposition. But I was talking in church about, you know, how we can get involved. And then we went out to lunch together. And this was the mission committee of this church, if you can bear that in mind. We went to a coffee shop / lunch place, sort of like a Panera's. And we're sitting there. And they tell me that their missions committee is quite a fellowship, and they go to that restaurant almost every Sunday after church. Well, while we're sitting there, they point out a young woman behind the counter who's washing dishes, and she has a hijab on, the head covering of Islam, Muslim women, and they lean over to me and they say, "You see that girl over there?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "She's a Muslim." And they were whispering it like, you know, no one knew. And I said, "I think she knows," you know, in other words. And then I said to them, "Now, you come here regularly, right?" "Yeah." What's her name?" "Oh, we don't know." "Well, where is she from?" "We don't know. Is she a Shiite or a Sunni? Why is she here? Does she go to a local mosque? You know, what? Who is she?" "We don't know. We don't know. We don't know." And I said, "Why?" I said, "Well, we've never actually met her. We've never introduced ourselves. We never started a conversation with her." So they're concerned about North Africa, but they're not willing to reach out to the one they could actually touch. And so after the lunch, they were out in the parking lot looking for the guest speaker, namely me, because they had lost me. And I came out, and, you know, within 8 minutes, I think it was 10 minutes, I knew the girl's name. I knew that she was a Shiite. I knew that she was from this country, and her father's a professor at the university, and they don't really go to the local mosque because it's a Sunni place, but she goes to a private prayer place in her house. And I was the first Christian that had really started a conversation with her. Okay. And, you know, I understand what it is to feel overwhelmed, but if we don't start right where we are, you know, if we don't start befriending people from other countries, other world religions, if we don't start learning so that we can actually express the gospel, we're overlooking the people that God has brought to us. And when Toronto pastor said it this way, he said, "God called us to go to all the nations. We didn't go, so he's bringing all the nations to us." And I think my encouragement is, all right, maybe you can't solve worldwide poverty, but you could certainly adopt a child through Compassion Project. You know, maybe you can't solve the world's water problem, but you could join something like, you know, different Christian ministries that dig wells and help people get access to clean water. You know, we could do something just because you can't do everything. And I think that's, and of course, one of the themes in the book too is God is the Lord of the harvest, and intercession or prayer is definitely part of our ongoing fulfillment, if you will, of being part of the Great Commission.
Paul, just as we can resonate with that story, because we've all been in situations like that, you have just gotten, comfortable asking questions and visiting with people. So go back to that illustration and said, you know, while the rest of the missions committee are out in the parking lot, you're back having a conversation with this young lady. Just so, what does that look like? You just sort of boldly ask, "What's your name? Where are you from?"
Well, first I said, "I can tell by your hijab you're a Muslim." And, you know, it's an interesting thing because people go running. And right now, at least in our country, there's so much press on issues of fear, right? And, you know, the Bible says in the book of Proverbs, the wicked flee when no one is pursuing, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. And so I just basically say, you know, and I've never talked with a Hindu, a Buddhist, a Sikh, a Muslim, who's not happy to tell you about their faith. And so, you know, you just start off, and it does help. And let me make a reference to another book. There's a man named Winfried Cordowan. I think he's a professor at Taylor University, wrote a book called Neighboring Faiths. And Neighboring Faiths basically gives a Christian overview of all the major world religions. And at the end of each chapter, he has a section called So You Meet a Muslim, So You Meet a Hindu, So You Meet a Buddhist. And it gives you suggestions of how to start the conversation. You know, so you just basically ask. And so I just said to her, you know, I actually went up and gave her an Islamic greeting. I said, Salaam Alaikum, which is the only phrase I really know in Arabic, but it works, you know. And I'm not saying God is greatest and I'm going to explode you. I'm basically saying peace be upon you, which is a Muslim greeting in most of the Muslim world. And so it just started with that. And she was very friendly. And I said, do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions? You know, because she told me where she was from and everything. And if someone seems uncomfortable, I'm, you know, going to back down. And I'm not going to make them feel awkward. But on the other hand, let me share another story that happened right here in Boston. In April of 2013 was when the Boston Marathon bomb thing happened, right?
Yeah.
About a month later, I was in Logan Airport getting ready for a flight, and there was one of those little kiosk things, little wagons where they're selling gum and snacks and all. And there was a young lady standing there. She was the attendant, and she had the hijab on. And I went up to her, and I said, Salaam Alaikum. She started crying. I said, what's the matter? She goes, in the last month since the Boston Marathon, you're the first person who spoke to me.
Hmm.
You know, because everybody looked at her and blamed her for the Zainaya brothers. And, you know, we need to realize that we need to see people through the eyes of God's love, you know, and not see them as our enemy combatants, but see them, even if we see them as enemies. What did Jesus say? You know, bless your enemies, bless those who curse you, pray for them. You know, so I just try to get bold about it. But, you know, again, it's not to make everybody feel awkward. And nowadays, sometimes when I ask somebody if they're where they're from or what their faith is, they look at me kind of suspiciously. And then because of travel, I oftentimes, oh, I've been there, you know, so that helps them feel a little bit more comfortable.
We'll talk more about ways that we can go and do with Paul Borthwick. We're talking Great Commission, Great Compassion. That's the title of his new book, Following Jesus and Loving the World. Paul is a speaker, a pastor, a writer, and joining us today on Connecting Faith. There's more coming up in just a moment. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Glad to have you listening in today as we're talking about a bigger vision of the world and how God's call to us to go and to preach the gospel. We also have to demonstrate God's love as well. And that's summed up well in the brand new book from Paul Borthwick called Great Commission, Great Compassion, Following Jesus and Loving the World. Paul is a speaker and teacher. He's the senior consultant for Development Associates International. And he's written a number of books, including, How to Be a World-Class Christian, Six Dangerous Questions to Transform Your View of the World, A Mind for Missions, and a number of other books. He teaches regularly at Gordon College as well, teaching global Christianity. The new book, Great Commission, Great Compassion, is from InterVarsity. As you were talking during the last segment about, understanding the world around us, you, I think, were in a group at one time, talked about you wanted to learn a little bit about everything and a lot about something. Just say a little bit more about how we can maybe expand our vision to start with. I mean, it starts, I'm sure, with just asking questions of the people around us, but what do you recommend in terms of studying and understanding the world in which we live?
Well, let me go back to the phrase itself. It was actually a college age group that I was in when I was in college. I think it was a number of us had gone to the Urbana Student Missionary Convention. We were all 18, 19, 20 years old. And one of the things that we were challenged about was learning about the world. Because depending on how you count the statistics, the United States, our country, is basically 5 to maybe 6% of the entire world population. And yet we live and act oftentimes like we're 99% of the world's population. And so we decided that we would have this little fellowship group, and the goal was to learn something about everywhere and everything about somewhere. So something about everywhere would start with geography, you know, learning where the countries of the world are. It staggers me to read a statistic in an article not too long ago that told that said that something in the neighborhood of 50% of American university students could not find Iraq on the map of the world. Now, I mean, all right, if you can't find Brunei or Djibouti on the map of the world, I'm with you. But Iraq's, it's not like it hasn't been in the news. You know, but we live in this world of this bubble of geographic ignorance. So everything about somewhere might be countries, it might be learning some of the leaders in the world, you know, so we can pray for kings and rulers and those who are in authority. But then to learn something about everywhere, everything about somewhere meant that each one of us would take a country or an issue. So one guy back in the 80s, one guy was learning about apartheid, another person was learning about Albania, somebody else was learning about North Korea. And so you try to get a lot of information, and then you share it together and kind of pool that knowledge. But for each one of us, you know, we can stay alert to the world by once in a while, at least, listening to an international news broadcast. And I'm not talking about a 20-minute soundbite newscast. I'm talking about something maybe a la the BBC that goes into greater detail of some of these stories and learning about other parts of the world. Are reading newsletters from mission agencies or missionaries, you know, following a specific issue. Maybe it's the persecution of the church in Iran. And so you learn that the ministry called Elam, E-L-A-M, down in Atlanta, that connects people with the church in Iran so we can pray for them. Basically, just developing what I would simply call a global curiosity, you know, the ability to ask questions about the world. What is that like? What does it mean? You know, we hear things on the news like Sunnis versus Shiites versus Wahhabis, and yet most people have no idea what we're talking about, only that it's something to do with Islam. And learning about the fuel crisis that's still striking the poor people of Nepal who are still recovering from two devastating earthquakes, that kind of stuff, it just bypasses us, which goes to your point about suffering.
Yeah.
One of the issues that I talk about in the book is the issue of apathy. And apathy, literally, the word does not mean that we don't care. The word literally means that we don't feel. And, you know, there's an earthquake in Haiti. The first day we're overwhelmed. The second day we want to send a gift. 2 weeks later, it's like, what earthquake? You know, we become used to it. And that's one of the most difficult parts of living in an oversaturated world with information, that sometimes we won't know anything about what's going on with the earthquake in Haiti, but we know all the names of the Kardashian children. And it's just embarrassing sometimes, but that's the way I'm not pointing any fingers at anybody other than myself. You know, yeah. Am I more concerned about how the New England Patriots are doing than how the Christians are doing in the refugee camps of Syria, you know, and trying to, that's where it comes back to making a choice. And that's not to say I don't watch football or anything like that. It's just to say I'm going to choose what the priority concerns of my life are.
You used, quoted a phrase, talked about compassion permanence. I like that. Just say a little bit more about, describe what that is.
Yeah, it's not an original to me. It's from a guy named Gary Haugen, who's the founder of the International Justice Mission. And he points out that in children, I guess it's child psychologists, have realized that children, babies, infants, don't have object permanence. And he says object permanence is when you realize that something, even if you don't see it, it still exists. So for a baby in a crib, you know, you dangle the rattle in front of them, and they look at it, they laugh at it, they play with it. Take it away, evidently, according to child psychologists, they don't say to themselves, gee, where is the rattle? For them, it ceased to exist. And Gary Haugen goes on to say, compassion permanence, we have a lot of compassion impermanence. He said, you know, we see something, we go on a short-term mission trip, you know, we experience a refugee camp or something like that. And in that moment, we are thoroughly engrossed. But as soon as we start flying home, we go to Terminal 5 and Heathrow Airport, you know, go shopping at Harrods. And within a second, everything that we've seen in that refugee camp is forgotten. And what Gary Haugen is saying, we need to realize the people that we saw on that video last Sunday are still in that refugee camp. You know, the people that we heard about suffering in the prison on the, you know, day of prayer for the persecuted church, they're still there 6 or 8 or 10 weeks later. And just to remember the fact, as it says in the book of Hebrews, you know, to remember those in prison or to remember those who are suffering as if we were suffering with them.
You mentioned Peter Kuzmich suggesting that the great compassion coming out of Matthew 25. I'm just interested maybe to say more about what would Matthew 25 look like today if we were really going to you know, make a conscious effort to apply that in our lives.
Well, obviously the first application, because there's some debate as to, you know, it says when Jesus says, as you did it to each of these my brothers, or the least of these my brothers. So is he talking only about Christians, or is he talking about the whole world? I'll say the passage itself may be limited to specific, you know, fellow Christians who are suffering. But even if we do that, there's still a vast array of need to which we can respond. Because for those of us in the Western world, for those of us in North America, we need to realize many, if not most, of our Christian family is economically poor. You know, most of them, many of them have live with a level of inconvenience that we simply would not, you know, tolerate, or we would not even envision. And so, but Matthew 25 lived out, if I could put it in a simple phrase, it's changing the way we look at people. It's realizing it's compassion literally means to suffer with, and we are willing to sort of embrace some of their suffering. So, you know, during the Christmas season, we say, I'm going to cut back on my gift giving, or I'm going to cut back on my gift asking, and instead I'm going to ask that somebody give to this ministry or to that opportunity in my name, and that's the way I'll celebrate. You know, it's the willingness to basically say, everybody doesn't have the life that I have. How can I identify with my brothers and sisters in need? And it could be entertaining international students at the holidays. You know, I was a stranger and you welcomed me in. It could be getting involved in ministry to the homeless. You know, I was hungry and you fed me. It could mean donating clothes. Good clothes. Don't donate your rags. Donate the rags to a place that waxes cars. You know, give your good clothes, or give something good to the homeless shelter. You know, all those things. It could be working with the mentally handicapped. It could be working with physically handicapped. It's basically developing the capacity not to forget about ourselves, but to get past our own needs to care for somebody else's need.
We've talked in the past about your wonderful book on simplicity, and it's based on, I think, kind of just a bumper sticker, and yet it really is a pretty profound change in the way that we actually live life, isn't it?
Yeah, the bumper sticker that I don't know who sponsored it, but it said, to live more simply that others may simply live. And, you know, I was reading an article about how so many Americans are really upset this year because they don't have as much money to spend on their flat screen TVs and their, you know, Game Boys and their PlayStations, and I'm saying, really? That's something to be upset about? And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we've forgotten that a part of the Christian life is not caring only for our own needs, but for the needs of others, you know, following Jesus' example. And that's why, you know, Neil, if you want to give me a present for my birthday or for Christmas and you say, you know, I'm giving you three goats that are going to a family in Haiti, I'll be very happy for that. And I don't even have to tell you my size. You
can sure.
Any size goat you want.
I did actually buy a goat and a couple of chickens, you know, just a few weeks ago for someone, and just you know, a good thing to do, just as a way to express, you know, the blessings that we have and obviously the needs of those around us. We're talking Great Commission, Great Compassion. That's the title of Paul Borthwick's new book. Paul serves as a senior consultant for Development Associates International. He's a teacher and a speaker, former pastor, and author of a number of books. We're going to continue in just a moment here in Connecting Faith and talk about praying for the world. And we want to get into maybe even just the welcoming the stranger. That's become kind of a politicized issue today. We'll get Paul's perspective on that just ahead. Listening to Connecting Faith, and we're honored to have connected with Paul Borthwick again today. I've had Paul on in the past. He's been a friend, and so appreciate his writing and his insights as we look at seeing the world as Jesus sees the world. What does that look like to not only follow Jesus, but to love the world? And that's the subtitle of the new book, Great Commission, Great Compassion, Following Jesus and Loving the World. It is published from InterVarsity Press. And Paul, one of the things that you mentioned to just kind of in passing earlier was about praying for the world. That's a key aspect that we somehow maybe overlook and don't do it effectively. So how do we pray for the world, and what do we pray about or for?
Well, I always remember the fact that, you know, it comes naturally for most of us to pray about our own needs. I mean, that just goes without saying. And there's nothing wrong with that. We should pray about, you know, Jesus, so the Bible actually says, you know, cast all your cares on Jesus because he cares for you. You know, don't be anxious about anything, but by prayer and thanksgiving with, prayer and request with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. So bottom line is, we always pray that, but we have a God who sits on the throne of the universe, King of the world, you know, Lord of history. And we forget to go and make requests. You know, it sounds absurd, but I'm actually praying for ISIS. Not that they would be wiped out, but that they would be converted. And you might say, what? But my God is big enough to do that, because in the first century, there was a terrorist who thought he was serving God by killing Christians, who became Paul the Apostle. And God could show up in the dreams. Imagine if every Christian in the world was praying for ISIS to have visions of Jesus. Mm. You know, Jesus, come down. You know, when I go to prayer, I realize I'm not just talking to my sugar daddy, Jesus. I'm talking about the Lord of the history, who basically says, pray for kings, pray for rulers, pray for those who are in authority. You know, because it's in our best interest, according to Romans, it'll help build a peace in the world, but it also is way bigger than anything I could ever do on my own. You know, I use the illustration in the book that imagine if the President of the United States called you asking for your requests in the world, and then the Premier of China called you, and then Ban Ki-moon or whoever it is who's now in charge of the United Nations calls you, all saying, you know, what would you like us to do in the world? Well, God's inviting that. And I think we sometimes undersell. And prayer, at least in my own experience, is the best way for me to overcome my fears. You know, it's amazing. It's so much easier to be afraid of the unknown than to say, Jesus, you're going with me into the unknown. And that might be, you know, when I start a conversation at the Panera's with a young lady from the Middle East, or it might be when I, you know, finally get the opportunity to go into a Muslim country and do a prayer walk. But all that's to say, God enables us. He assures us of his presence when we pray.
And I know you even talk about, you know, we pray, you know, for God to bless us and, you know, health and provision things, but we can expand that sort of prayer blessing to others, even just to those in our neighborhood, right?
Yeah, well, I actually sometimes will pray what I call concentric circle praying out of Acts chapter 1, verse 8, one of the Great Commission statements. You know, I start with my own Jerusalem and, you know, pray for the concerns in my own household or my own life. Then Judea would be the greater region. It could be my neighborhood. It could be my city or my state. Samaria could be the people that I know are in the area that I don't know. For example, where I live, there's one town. There's, I think it's 15,000 people live in this one town who come from Morocco. And so I, you know, that might be my Samaria. And then to the ends of the earth, you know, praying something global, either something I heard on the news or saw on the internet, or, you know, basically just reminding myself that God is not, he's concerned about the details of my life and the hairs on my head, but that's not his only concern. And I need to remember that when I go before God. One thing that I don't know if it appears in this book, but I encourage everybody, if they don't even know what to pray for or where to pray for, just at the end of each day or at the beginning of the day, when you're putting your clothes on or changing into your pajamas, pray for the country on the label of your clothes. Yeah. You know, because I would say 80 or 90% of the clothes that we're wearing are assembled or made someplace else. And, you know, China will get a fair amount of prayer, and India might get a lot of prayer, and Sri Lanka will certainly get some prayer. And then you then take that a step further and pray for the person who made those clothes. Because if my shirt says made in Bangladesh, I'm almost positive that a Muslim man has made it. If it says made in Sri Lanka, I'm almost positive a Sri Lankan Buddhist, probably lady, has made that shirt. And that's an individual that God knows. Yeah. You know, I might have said this too on an earlier broadcast with you, but I fantasize being in heaven and having someone at that heavenly worship service come over and say, thank you for praying, I made your shirt. You know, because God is the God of the nations.
A practical, simple way to not only expand our vision, but to see what it means to go and to do in ways that we can do this. Say more about doing, because you address advocacy. Is there maybe a right way and a wrong way to advocate? We pray, we also want to act.
Yeah, when I talk about advocacy, I'm talking about we as evangelical Christians especially, and I'm speaking for myself too here, we don't know as much about how to navigate the world of what would be called institutional evil. You know, the situation that puts mentally handicapped people out on the streets because they're not self-endangering, or the systems that sometimes perpetuate poverty in other countries of the world. And advocacy is becoming a person who's willing to speak up for those who, if they speak, are not going to be heard. So I mentioned before International Justice Mission. They do advocacy on behalf of children in the child labor trade, or women in the sex trade, or women and men in the sex trade. You know, you're advocating for someone who can't speak for themselves. Advocating in your church that there be an offering for those working with a group like World Relief, with refugee camps of people coming out of the horrible war in Syria. You know, that you're speaking for people whose voice is not going to be heard unless someone speaks for them. Advocacy is basically being a representative spokesperson for someone who has a need. You know about it, and you can recruit others to be involved with you.
We're living in a day where, welcoming the strangers, being politicized. What do we need to remember about you know, what God has to say to those that are coming, that, you know, that we come in contact with, our neighbors.
Well, that my experience, number one, is that it's easier to stereotype than it is to reach out. Hmm. You know, number two, it's easier to run away in fear than it is to open our arms. And number three, it's easy to confuse American ideals and American dream lifestyle with what God wants for everybody. Now, I'm going to say something that will upset some of your listeners, I'm sure. But we need to remember, God's first goal for us is not our safety. His first goal for us is our obedience. And, you know, if you think that it's always going to be safe, then we need to remember that Jesus was the ultimate in obeying God, and it certainly wasn't safe for him. Having said that, you know, the vast majority of the neediest people coming here as refugees, as immigrants, they're not coming here to destroy us. They're coming here for a better life. And I think that's where the eyes of compassion play a part. And when it comes to radical other world, people who are radicalized in other world religions, because there are radicalized Buddhists, there are radicalized Muslims, there are radicalized Hindus, there are radicalized Christians in some places who go in and shoot up abortion clinics thinking they're doing God's will. You know, if we limit ourselves to that stereotype, then we won't take any action. We'll sit in our house with our guns and protect ourselves until Jesus takes us. But if we live a Christian life, it's seeing people through Jesus' eyes, even to the point of taking the risks. Radicalized people, or people who are tending in that direction, they become more radicalized if they come into our country and we hate them. We force them to go hang out with people like themselves. Whereas if we invite them in, they'll actually have a reason to believe that not all Americans are this way or that way. And I'm not running for president, but and if I were, I probably wouldn't get any votes based on that. But I'm just encouraging people, when you think through whatever the candidates are saying, Democrat or Republican or independent, let's make sure we evaluate it by the example of Jesus.
Paul, we only have about maybe 90 seconds left or less. I guess under you closed the book talking about witnessing to all the senses. Just give a final challenge for us to go and to do.
Well, this idea came when I was reading the 2 Corinthians passage where it says that we are the fragrance of Christ, the aroma of Christ. And I got thinking about it. You know, we preach to the sense of hearing. We enhance the quality of other people's life by being salt, which is what salt does with food. We push out the darkness by being light to the sense of sight. We welcome the stranger. We feed the hungry, appealing to the sense of touch. But then that unusual phrase in 2 Corinthians 2, where it says we are the fragrance of Christ, what it is sometimes just by our gracious word, our gracious action, giving up a parking space, opening the door for someone else, we're leaving behind the sweet aroma of Jesus so that people will see that through multiple Christians and they'll say, I've smelled that before. I wonder what it is.
Pray that that fragrance would be abounding in 2016, not just in our neighborhoods, but around the world as we learn to live out the Great Commission and the Great Compassion. Great Commission, Great Compassion is the name of the new book from Paul Borthwick, Following Jesus and Loving the World. Paul serves as Senior Consultant for Development Associates International and is a international speaker and teacher and author. We're grateful for the opportunity to connect with him and be challenged again. Paul, wish you great blessing and opportunities in 2016. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thanks again, Neil.